Peter's Denials, the second talk in a series entitled, Is the Bible Trustworthy? Responding to Bart Ehrman, was presented by Jack Crabtree on November 27, 2011, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2011. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. The handout to which Dr. Crabtree refers in this talk is handout number 2 in this series.
As most of you probably know, I'm weaving together two series. On the one hand, I'm doing a series on biblical philosophy, the message and worldview of the Bible, and subtitled Why Jesus Would Not Be a Christian. And the reason for that subtitle is I'm arguing that the faith that you get by believing and trusting in the worldview and the message of the Bible is distinct and different from a faith that's based in Christian traditions and institutions and basically centered in the truth rather than in the Bible. And I'm going to gradually, bit by bit, make my case for that as we work our way through that. But that, of course, presupposes that the Bible is worth trusting, that we should believe in the worldview and the message of the Bible. And the Bible has come under incredible attack over the last century, and certainly in the last half a century. And interweaving with the other series, I'm going to be spending some time basically arguing for the trustworthiness of the Bible. And in order to do that, I'm taking on a bestseller, fairly well known in our culture, a modern book called Jesus Interrupted, in revealing the hidden contradictions in the Bible and why we don't know about them, by a professor named Bart Ehrman. So I started that last week, and I'm going to continue that today. Last week, we looked at this distinction that Ehrman makes between a devotional approach to the Bible and what he calls a historical critical approach to the Bible. And the devotional approach to the Bible, as he looks at it, as he sees it, and I would agree with him, is where you bring your religious assumptions to the text and you basically create pious fictions from the Bible that shore up and support your Christian worldview. So it's an escape from truth. You're not really seeking to discover the truth when you take the devotional approach. You're just using the Bible as a prop to spin out pious fictions that lend support to the beliefs that you already hold. In contrast to that, he suggests what he calls the historical critical approach. The historical critical approach on the surface sounds great. It sounds like an approach that I think we should take to the Bible. Going to the Bible to discover what it means in its time and place, in the intention of the author who wrote it, as it was intended for the readers for whom it was written. That would make all the sense in the world if that's what the historical critical approach actually did. But what I argued last week, the way the so-called historical critical approach that he's advocating gets practiced, it deals in fictions of its own. Not pious fictions, but academic fictions. But I don't care whether they're pious fictions or academic fictions. A fiction is a fiction, and it's a way to avoid confronting the truth, avoid discovering the truth, rather than a way to the truth. So as I argued last week, I reject what he calls the historical critical approach because it's not really looking for answers. It comes to the text already with its answers in mind, and just like the pious approach, tries to read its answers into the text. So what I would propose instead is an entirely different alternative, a third alternative, that is using my common sense, my ordinary intelligence, the rationality that God gave me, the ability to look at language that I have learned over the course of my life, and to simply treat the Bible the way I would any other book. That includes what I called last week the principle of charity. That is, instead of that, if what looks like a contradiction in the text, I first try to see whether I'm misinterpreting it and that I have created the contradiction, that the contradiction is not in the text itself. And I will do my best to give a sympathetic reading to the text to try to understand why the author is not an idiot and why the author has not overlooked an obvious contradiction. Okay, last week we looked at the first so-called contradiction that he suggests, and that's between the account of Jesus cleansing the temple in John versus Mark and the other synoptic gospels. And the so-called problem or tension there was John locates it as in the very, very opening of Jesus' public ministry, one of his very early trips to Jerusalem on Passover, and that's where he locates it in time, while the synoptic gospels locate it in time in the very last week of Jesus' life here on earth. And so the problem is, how can they both be right? They're not locating it at the same time. He dismisses out of hand the idea that it happened twice, and I argued last week that as much as he seems to think that that's an implausible suggestion, I argued not only is it plausible, it makes all the sense in the world, and that we're actually dealing with two different events. The first event being probably John was one of the few eyewitnesses to it, and he includes it in his account because part of John's purpose in his gospel is to fill in from his own eyewitness experience the record that is the story that has not been told by the other records. Now, you may have some questions about that, and I'm going to try to leave plenty of time for discussion today, but I do want to look at his next so-called problem first before I open it up. The next problem is in the accounts of Peter's denial of Jesus. So I'm going to just try to hit the highlights, and if you're really interested in diving into this, I suggest that you get a hold of my handout and study my solution to Jesus or to Peter's denials. Let me see if I can give you a very quick orientation to what he sees as the problem. It begins in an earlier chapter where the prediction of Jesus, where Jesus makes a prediction that Peter's going to deny him. Matthew, it goes from Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John in that order from left to right in the columns up there. Matthew basically predicts that this very night before a rooster crows, you will deny me three times. You get virtually the same thing in Luke. The rooster will not crow today until you have denied me three times. And John, a rooster will not crow until you deny me three times. So that seems straightforward enough. The night is going to pass. During the night before the rooster crows, you're going to deny me three times. The problem, Ehrman says, comes in Mark. Because Mark says, this very night, before a rooster crows twice, you will deny me three times. So the question he raises is, well, who has it right? Is it before the rooster crows or before the rooster crows twice? Can't be both. So either the tradition that Matthew, Luke, and John, the story they're telling is false, or the story that Mark is telling is false. Then you get into the accounts of the denials themselves. The first denial that gets recorded in all the Gospels is a servant girl. In Matthew, says, you too were with Jesus the Galilean, the servant girl says. Mark has the servant girl say, you also were with Jesus the Nazarene. Now, how picky are we going to get here? Did he say Galilean or did he say Nazarene? Does that matter? We'll have to talk about that. Luke has the servant girl saying, this man was with him too, where the him is Jesus. And John has the slave girl. They translate it slave girl in the New American Standard. It's the same word in Greek as servant girl, so that's not really a difference in the Greek text. John adds that it was the doorkeeper. That servant girl was the doorkeeper. And has her say, you are not also one of this man's disciples, are you? Notice that in Matthew and Mark, it's addressed at Jesus, the servant girl saying to Jesus, you were with Jesus the Galilean, were with Jesus. In Luke, it's addressing to other people about Jesus, this man was with him too. And then the slave girl asks a question directed at Peter. You are not also one of this man's disciples, are you? So we can ask the question, well, which was it? Was he talking to Peter? Was he talking to the other bystanders? Or was he making an accusation instead of asking a question, talking to Peter and making an accusation? Can't be all of those things, so one of those must be wrong. Peter responds in Matthew, I do not know what you are talking about. Mark, I neither know nor understand what you are talking about. Luke, woman, I do not know him. And John, I am not. Or is there a difficulty there? I don't know. I don't think so. There's not a lot of difference there. The bigger differences come in when we get to the second denial. Matthew has the accusation coming from another servant girl, and it's made about Jesus to the bystanders. This man was with Jesus. I thought I had that fixed. This man was with Jesus of Nazareth. In Mark, he notes that a rooster crowed after the first denial, and then he has the servant girl begin again. This is one of them. And Luke does not have it another servant girl per se. It just says heteros in Greek, another. And we have to decide what is that another referring to. But he doesn't specify it as a servant girl. You are one of them. John just has they. Not a servant girl, but a plurality of people, they. Asking a question again. You are not also one of his disciples, are you? Okay, again, is it third person talking about Jesus to bystanders? Is he asking a question of Jesus, or is he making an accusation of Jesus? The different accounts all do different things there. And furthermore, who's doing it? Is it another servant girl? Is it another man? Or is it just they? Peter, in Matthew, responds, I do not know the man, and he does it with an oath. He responds with an oath. Mark just says he denied it, doesn't give us the language. Peter says, man, I am not. And then John says, I am not as well. Then finally, in the last denial, Matthew and Mark both have bystanders making the accusation. And they are charging him. Surely you too are one of them, for even the way you talk gives you away. Or Mark has, surely you are one of them, for you are a Galilean too. Luke has it being made to other people, not directed at Peter, but directed to other people about him. And it suggests that it's another man who is doing it. Certainly this man also is with him, for he is a Galilean too. And then in John, there's a relative of the slave whose ear Peter cut off, who says, or asks him to Peter, did I not see you in the garden with him? Having noticed that he had chopped his relative's ear off. Matthew, cursing and swearing, I do not know the man, and a rooster crows. Mark, Peter, cursing and swearing, I do not know this man you are talking about. Luke, man, I do not know what you are talking about, and a rooster crows. And finally in John, Peter denied it, and a rooster crows. And in Mark, the rooster crows the second time. Okay, so what is Ehrman worried about here? What he's concerned about is we don't really seem to have, how can we have an accurate picture of what's happening in these events when you seem to have different people making the charges? The form of the charge is different, a question, a comment to Peter, a comment about Peter. They don't seem to have their story straight. So from Ehrman's perspective, we don't have a trustworthy account because these can't all be true. They are in conflict with one another. Well, there's several, you know, details that we would need to think about. The main issue, the main problem gets created by dividing out the three charges that you find in the Gospel of John as if they were parallel to the three charges in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. They are not, I would maintain. I would argue that at the second time Peter denies, John does not have an account of the second denial. He just omits it from his account. And I'll talk about why in a second. So instead, you have the servant girl in Matthew and Mark and just another in Luke, all of them saying, this man was with Jesus of Nazareth, this is one of them, or directed at Peter, you are one of them. And you don't have a corresponding account in John. Instead, what you have is John indicating a rather complex event in the third denial. In the third denial, you have Matthew and Mark, the bystanders, saying, surely you're one of them. We can tell by your accent. You talk funny. You must be one of them. The third one, Luke, is some other man or some other person. Certainly that this man also was with him, for he is a Galilean too. And that's where belongs the they saying, you are not also one of his disciples, are you? And then Peter denying that, saying, I am not, a slave who's a relative of the man who had his ear cut off, says, did I not see you in the garden with him? And Peter denied that, and then the rooster crowed. But that's all happening on the same occasion. Okay, now let me reconstruct what I think happened, and it'll make more sense out of what I just did there. Peter and John were in the garden. The temple guard comes and arrests Jesus, takes him to the residence of Caiaphas, the sitting chief priest, takes him into a room where Annas, the real high priest, the patriarch behind the high priestly family, interrogates Jesus first before Jesus is taken to the Sanhedrin to be tried. Apparently, Annas wants to get dirt on Jesus and figure out a strategy. What sort of questioning do we need to conduct during the trial that will catch him up and we will convince the Sanhedrin that this is a dangerous man who needs to be executed? Annas wants to figure that out ahead of time. So Jesus is not taken directly to Caiaphas and the Sanhedrin. He's taken to Annas in a different part of the residence. While all that is happening, John and Peter follow the temple guard back to Caiaphas' residence. John goes up to the door, knocks on the door, and immediately receives entry. Why? John has relatives in Jerusalem, wealthy relatives in Jerusalem, who are connected with the high priestly family. The servant knows him and recognizes him immediately and directly and has no problem with him entering. So John enters. Peter is another story. Peter gets left behind. I think apparently in the confusion, John doesn't immediately realize that Peter didn't come in with him because he gets into the inner court. John tells us without Peter, goes back out to the door, talks to the slave girl who's the doorkeeper and asks her permission to let Peter in. So she lets Peter in as well. Inside the courtyard, outside the building where they're having the trial, they're in the courtyard. It's a relatively chilly evening. The soldiers and the servants have built a fire in the middle of the courtyard, and they are warming themselves around the fire. John and Peter join them. As they're sitting there, Peter now is facing the fire and is in the light of the fire. The slave girl has come in to join them at the fire, the doorkeeper who let John and Peter in. She comes from the door, sits around the fire with them. Now she can see Peter in the light of the fire, and she says, you're one of them, aren't you? Now, the question at this point is, how do you count a denial? If she says, you are one of them, aren't you, and then turns to the crowd gathered, the soldiers and the other servants there, and says, I think he's one of them. And who knows how many other people may have joined in. How are we to count how many times Jesus denies that he knows the Lord in that kind of situation? I would argue it's once. He may have made multiple statements of denial on that occasion as he sat there at the fire. He may have said, no, I'm not. And someone else said, yes, you are. And he said, no, I'm not. And he said, yes, you are. And he said, no, I'm not. I mean, that could have happened 24 times, but it's still only one denial in the way that Jesus is counting this thing, because it's just a rapid fire interaction with people who are making accusations to him, about him, and questioning him, and are just simply asking, aren't you one of his disciples? I think you're one of his disciples, and making the accusation. It gets a little hot at the fire for Peter, so Peter leaves. And he makes his way back out into the arches that would have surrounded the courtyard, back into the arches around the porch, in order to get into the dark and escape scrutiny by the slaves and soldiers that were there. As he's out there, another slave girl, and there are apparently other people standing out under the porches, Another slave girl recognizes him and raises the same question and makes the same accusations to the bystanders around there. He again denies it. Now, we're talking, there's a separation in time from the time that he was around the fire until the time that he's accused again out in the porch. Minutes, maybe close to an hour time difference. He's had time to think about what he did the first time. That's what's critical. He's had time to think about it. And Mark tells us when he went out into the porches, a rooster crowed. In Mark, remember, he's going to deny Jesus before the rooster crows twice. Why is that significant? The first sound of the rooster was a warning shot. Peter, dig it. Remember what I said to you. And yet, he nonetheless doesn't heed the warning. Maybe he doesn't even get it. It doesn't even register. But when confronted again for a second time, he denies Jesus again. How many times on that occasion did he say he denied him? We don't know. It could have been multiple times again with multiple people making the accusation. We just don't have that kind of detail. Then John, maybe it's Luke, one of the Gospels tells us an hour passes. And after an hour has passed, we find him back in the courtyard around the fire once again. He had tried to escape into the anonymity of the shadows. That didn't work so good. So you can either be cold and under scrutiny or warm and under scrutiny. He chose warm and under scrutiny and went back to the fire again. Back at the fire again, and notice that in the three accounts, Matthew and Mark say the bystanders. John says they. They begin again. I think you're one of them. Your accent gives you away. You're a Galilean. I know you're one of them. You must be one of them. To which he persistently denies that that's the case. And then something very Hollywood-like happens. When you put the picture together, a rooster crows the second time. And just as the rooster is crowing the second time, Jesus is apparently, his trial is over, and he's being led out of the room to be held in custody, perhaps, or maybe he's directly on his way to visit Pilate at this point. But Jesus is left out of the room, and one of the Gospels said his eyes met Peter, and Peter remembered what Jesus had said, and he goes out and weeps bitterly. Well, my contention is every one of the accounts in these Gospels fits that scenario. The only difficulty arises in John. He seems to have Peter make three statements of denial, and yet they don't exactly match up with the three statements of denial in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. So what are we to make of that? My contention would be that John and Peter, we know from the gospel accounts, are together around the fire the first time he denies Jesus. Then Peter leaves. Does John go with him? I don't think so. John's not under scrutiny. Peter's under scrutiny. Peter's the one who flees to the shadows. John stays around the fire. So John was not an eyewitness to the second event when Peter denies Jesus. But then Peter comes back to the fire where John is with the soldiers and slaves. And now when they start accusing Peter the third time, John is there and he's an eyewitness to that. John's purpose in his gospel throughout, I would argue, is to give us information that he himself has firsthand knowledge of. Now, by firsthand knowledge, not everything that John tells us could be firsthand knowledge, but it's all either events that he was an eyewitness to or knowledge he was privy to because the Lord informed him directly himself. In any case, it's stuff that John knows personally and knows firsthand. So the reason he omits the second event of Peter denying Jesus is because he didn't know anything about that. He can't speak to that because he wasn't there. And the last event is a complex event that not only includes Peter being ganged up on by the various bystanders, but this very specific event of one of them recognizing him as having been in the garden and directly accuses him of that. And Peter lies through his teeth to deny that. I mean, he's lying through his teeth all along here, but for him to deny to this man's face who did recognize him from the garden that's not the case is a bold-faced lie that he tells. Okay, one of the responses that I could see someone like a Bart Ehrman making to the scenario that I painted would be, well, that's all fine and good. You can make it work, but you're just working really hard. Your imagination is working hard to create this scenario in order to make it fit, but it's completely concocted by you. Real life doesn't work that way. Well, my contention would be that's a clever response, but it just ain't true. Real life can be incredibly complex and incredibly full of what we think are remarkable coincidences or bizarre events or bizarre happenings. This one isn't even a good illustration of what I'm talking about because there's nothing particularly bizarre in this one. But I need to get it out on the table that real life history can be very implausible and very unbelievable. Decades ago, some of you in this room were there. Decades ago, I did a little thought experiment that was very revealing to me. It couldn't have worked better if I had planned it. Jody and I and our first child had been on a long vacation in a motorhome with another couple and their baby. And we had gone I was living in San Jose in the Bay Area at the time. We had gone up into the wilderness of Idaho, across Washington to the coast in Washington, back down to my parents in, where were you at the time? Eugene. And then eventually back down to San Jose over the course of a several week vacation. So I wrote out four different accounts of our vacation. And I deliberately decided to create the accounts as if I were accomplishing different purposes in each account. So understandably, some of the accounts involved much greater detail than the other accounts. Some of them were pretty Spartan with respect to details, were pretty trimmed down, and others of them were fuller. Then I took copies of these four accounts and I took them to a class that I was teaching at the time. And I said, we're going to determine whether or not these accounts are inerrant, are without any errors in them. And I handed out pieces of paper with clues. I think half of them said, they might be inerrant, they may not be inerrant, you figure it out. And to about 25% of the people, I said, these are inerrant. And to another 25%, I said, there are errors in here, find them. And then they as they studied those accounts, and then they argued with each other. And it was wonderful. It was an absolutely wonderful argument because it was exactly the kind of argument that someone like Bart Ehrman and I would have about the New Testament. And I remember it finally came down to the people who were arguing for errors in it said, okay, that's all very clever that you have reconciled these accounts to the people who were claiming they were inerrant. It's all very clever that you have done that, but your reconstruction requires that Jack's parents drove with them, alongside of them, from Eugene to Ashland, babysat for them in Ashland while they went to a play, said goodbye to them from Ashland, and then you drove all night from Ashland to San Jose. There's no way you could have got home when you said you got home unless you drove through the night from Ashland to San Jose. And that, I'm sorry, but that's just implausible. But as it turns out, it's exactly what happened. So you could see reconstructing that event in such a way where you reconcile the event, but you'd say, that's crazy. I mean, that couldn't have happened. Well, who are we to say that couldn't have happened? Only an eyewitness can possibly know for sure whether we're dealing with a simple, straightforward, completely plausible event or an utterly odd, bizarre, implausible event. But both kinds of events happen in real life history. So we can't start calling foul and error and contradiction just on the basis of it doesn't fit my sensibility about how simple an event was supposed to be. These events here were not as simple as you might want to read into them. These denials were not as simple as what you might want to read into them if you're just reading one of the accounts. If you don't try to look at them in parallel, you're going to probably think that Peter and John were around the fire. One person said, you must be one of his disciples, and he said no. A second person said, you must be one of his disciples, and he said no. And a third one said, you must be one of his disciples, and he said no. Bingo, the rooster crowed. He denied him three times. That would be simple, but that's not what went down. That's not how it happened. And all you have to do is pay attention to the events a little bit, and you realize this is way more complex than my simple little template that I'm bringing to it would suggest. For example, how bizarre would it be for the bystanders to say, now, what did they do? Have a choral director? All in unison now say, you must be one of them, Peter. Whenever, if you have something saying the bystanders said this, the only way the bystanders can be saying this is if it's a complex interaction between several people, an accusation of denial, an accusation of denial, an accusation of denial, an accusation of denial. Then it's the bystanders who are accusing him. So clearly, those gospel accounts, Matthew and Mark, who say the bystanders said this, are not intending this to be a simple statement or of accusation. They intend for me to understand this to be a complex, dynamic relationship between Peter and the people standing around the fire. He's simply, for the sake of his account, simplified it. He's not giving us all the details. All the details are not important. Not every statement do I need to know, as if the synoptic gospel writers would even know every statement, right? Because in these an account like this, we're not getting verbatim what anybody said. In the first place, it's in Greek, and they probably weren't speaking Greek. They were probably speaking Aramaic, maybe Hebrew, but probably speaking Aramaic. And so we don't have what they said in Aramaic. And do we have a direct translation of something that somebody recorded in Aramaic? Well, they didn't have tape recorders. It's not a transcription of a recording. It's a memory of the gist of what was being said to him. So we have to take all that into account as we ask the question, are these reconcilable? So, for example, when one of them accuses him of being Jesus the Nazarene and another one Jesus the Galilean, are those in conflict with each other? Well, not if you're simply recording the gist of the accusation. They're not in conflict. They would only be in conflict with each other if you're claiming to give a verbatim rendition of the accusation that was being made. But surely none of the gospel writers is claiming that. They're not claiming this is a transcription of a verbatim statement. Okay, I think that's enough. Let me open it up to your comments or questions.
So you said that you asked the question basically, what, did they have a choir director directing them to say everything in unison? So that
it
seems...
says the bystanders say, surely you two are one of them, for even the way you talk gives you away, or whatever.
Right.
What are we supposed to understand that as several of them in unison are making that statement?
Well, I wouldn't think so, but it seems... What is the mark of something that's plausible in the sense that... Obviously, there's a difference between thinking that the text is inerrant and thinking that something that the text asserts is plausible, because mm-hmm. you just made that assertion. You said, well, it's implausible that right. the bystanders would say that in unison.
Right.
So that's discounting some kind of thing. I mean,
right.
obviously people don't talk in unison all the time. So that, but also people don't go to a play in Ashland and then drive all night to get home to San Jose right. all the time either.
Right.
So what would you, how would you mark out that difference?
Okay. Yeah. I don't know that I can specify. I mean, that's the art of good sense. And it's something you need to develop over a lifetime. And as you're studying these kinds of accounts, you just have to develop a sense of it. But I think, wouldn't everyone here agree with me that that's implausible in a way that it's not implausible that John is not, well, I mean, I don't know what am I proposing this? Oh, okay. It's not implausible that the rooster crowed twice, I would argue. But this is implausible in a way that that is not. I mean, because we know that roosters crow multiple times in the morning before the sun rises, way too many multiple times before the sun rises. But only in musicals do you have people speaking in unison, the same line. And so the question is, you know, is this a musical or is this an actual historical event that's being described here? And to put it another way, even if you could convince me that it's plausible that they had a choir director and that they were speaking in unison, a vocal choir. What kind of account is this? This is an account that is not even claiming to describe verbatim what's being said. I mean, so if it's not even making that claim, why would I even think to possibly go that direction? I mean, I would imagine in the whole history of interpretation, nobody has ever proposed, wow, they got it in unison. I mean, I shouldn't think. But that's a great question. You know, what constitutes plausibility? And I don't think you can define that ahead of time. I mean, you have to develop the art, the skill at being able to discern what is historically plausible and what is not. And my complaint about the so-called historical critical method is, from in my experience, they don't practice that all that well. Because they have an agenda. And their agenda is, if there's any possible way that I can construe this to make it a problem, that must be right. Because there must be a problem in the text. Because they've already decided, before they even begin the project, that these are not works by a single mind that is giving you a coherent piece of literature. They've already decided this is stitched together as a hodgepodge of different traditions that somebody stitched together without any attention to what the final product would be, whether it would be coherent or not coherent. They've already decided that. And I'm just arguing, well, why would you already decide that? Can't we give it a break? I mean, can't we go there as a place of last resort, since tradition and the prima facie purpose of the book is to be the product of one single mind giving us a coherent account of the life and teaching of Jesus. Since on the surface that's what it's presenting itself as being, why don't I try that first? And if that fails, then I can go and ask myself the question, why did that fail? Could it be that it's a fraud to argue that it's a single work by a single man, by a single mind? Okay, then that would be a legitimate conclusion. But I think we have to, the principle of charity says, let's try to understand it as coherent to begin with. And if that works, then that's probably what it is, a coherent work by a single mind.
In keeping with the possibility that sometimes the language is vague, mm-hmm. It's the gist of things, to hear you speak, if I were following Peter around, I would probably count it like 25 denials.
Yeah, probably.
Like he told five right. people no.
Right.
Well, that counts as five. And then he told over here two people no, and then over there, you know. So,
but see, it only counts as five if you're counting statements of denial rather than occasions of denial.
Right. And that makes me wonder about Jesus' use of the word three. Do we have any indication that that is sort of a cultural metaphor for a completeness or even today in the Mideast culture, three denials, three agreements, three seems to pop up once in a while as we study it. So do we have any idea that I think the rabbis talked about when you say something three times, then you really mean it. Did you look at that?
No, I haven't looked at that. The only thing that comes to mind is, what is it in the law? Does it have to be three witnesses or is it two or three witnesses? I don't remember. No, I haven't looked at that. So I don't know. I think he means three. I think Jesus means count them, three, one, two, three. But that he's referring to on three different occasions. And three different occasions that are distinct enough in time, situated apart from each other in time, such that after each one you had time to think about it before you did it again. Oh, what I haven't commented on is the how do you reconcile one, he says, once you'll, before the rooster crows, you'll deny me three times, and Mark says, before the rooster crows twice. I think Mark is including greater detail than are the other gospel writers. Why? Tradition has it that Peter is the source behind the gospel of Mark. I think this event is etched on Peter's brain. I mean, like Peter was there, if you understand what I mean. Peter was there, and that first rooster sounding and the second rooster sounding that finally, you know, pierced him to the core, he has a vivid memory of it being two rooster crows just as Jesus had predicted. So that detail is included in Mark. It's simply omitted from the other writers as not that relevant to their purposes. So you have to read the accounts differently. What does Matthew mean when he records Jesus as saying, before this very night, before the rooster crows, you will deny me three times? What does that mean? Does that mean this very night before the rooster lets out a peep, you will deny me three times? Or does it mean this very night before the rooster announces the dawn of the next day, you will deny me three times? I think it's the latter. I mean, I think if you look at it in the context, all the other gospel writers are simply saying, before the new day has finished dawning, you will have denied me three times. And because Jesus indicated the dawning of the new day with a rooster crow, that's the way they record it. Before the rooster crows, before the rooster heralds the new day, you will have denied me three times. Mark is doing something different. Mark, which is probably true to what Jesus actually predicted, Mark is saying, before the rooster has sounded the second time, you will have denied me three times. So it's simply a more detailed, and it doesn't even really mean the same thing to talk about the rooster crowing in Matthew and the rooster crowing in Mark, if that's clear. The rooster crowing in Mark is the rooster sounding. The rooster crowing in Matthew and Luke is the rooster heralding the day, no matter how many peeps he lets out in doing so.
Sometimes words in Greek are sometimes mistranslated, or
that's right.
The cultural aspect is not understood. When he says three times, is there anything to indicate? I mean, one thing I've learned about ancient languages, they tend to be very rich in meaning, that there's a lot of context involved in understanding. So what do you know what the word that is used in Greek for the times, whether that can give any hint from that?
I'm not aware of anything noteworthy. I mean, I just think it's three times. Now, and there's an ambiguity there, as I pointed out.
Okay.
That is a time a statement or is it an occasion? And I don't think the word would help you in that.
Oh, okay. You answered my question. I just wanted to see if there was an ambiguity.
Yeah, no, I don't think so. I think it's just more vague than that. Yeah.
Jack, you might have just answered my question, but Peter and John were there personally, and so John is giving an accurate description of what he knew to be true. Mm-hmm. But then But then in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, they give the denial that's out on the gateway or
mm-hmm. the, right.
And so that seems to be more specific or more. And so I'm assuming that Peter must have relayed that to Mark. Is that what you're saying? Or
yes, and probably it entered into the tradition before Mark even wrote his gospel. Peter probably told that story
to the other
number of people.
Okay.
And that becomes a part of the memory of the whole church, I think,
okay.
of the whole community.
I want to relate back to something you said last week, and you kind of had a neat little quote saying, you can take the belief out of the fundamentalist, but not the fundamentalist out of the believer, in response to Ehrman. Can you elaborate more where you think he's coming from? Because you're inferring now that he's the fundamentalist agnostic. And is there anything more to this than the literal and the literal interpretation of the Bible and applying it and not... And saying
you mean
the
anything
Bible,
more to what I mean by fundamentalism? Than
yeah, and Ehrman, because you said that he thought that the Bible was written perfectly when he was a fundamentalist, or you implied the fundamentalist believed that.
Right, yeah, right. What I meant by that, it might have had a good ring to it, but it didn't communicate very well. What I meant by that is what we're going to find over and over and over again when he brings up these contradictions or problems in the Bible, many of them, not all of them, but many of them are based on a rather wooden, literalistic interpretation of the text. But instead of supporting that wooden, literalistic reading of the text and throwing his whole weight of faith behind it, as a believing fundamentalist might do, he then uses that wooden literalistic interpretation as ammunition against it. See, when you read it the way it is literally, there's a problem here. So his contention is, when you read it literally and woodenly, there's a problem here, so we should acknowledge it's not the Word of God and throw it out as the Word of God. My position is, if you read it literally and woodenly and literalistically and there's a problem there, stop reading it woodenly and literalistically. That just seems like a no-brainer to me, is that we have to, that's the principle of charity again. We'll come up with a great example here shortly. He gives us what I think he calls his favorite example, an example that I find just totally bizarre, because he's not even trying to understand what Jesus is saying. He's just taking the technical phrases that Jesus uses and finding a contradiction with earlier things in the text. Well, before I start calling contradiction and problem, why don't I understand it first? Why don't I see if I know what Jesus is saying and then decide whether there's a problem in the text? So I'll illustrate that when we get there.
Are you inferring then that fundamentalism does a surface kind of understanding?
Yeah, it's not necessarily endemic to fundamentalism, but in the culture that has come down to us, those people who tend to be and consider themselves fundamentalist, conservative, Bible-believing, that the prevailing attitude among them is to get stuck on the literal meanings of the words and dogmatically land there and stay there and refuse to think any further about it. They'll be very reluctant to let you say something is a metaphor, for example. So let me just give you an example. Jesus told a fable, and it's a fable about the rich man dying and Lazarus, who is a beggar at his gate. He went to the bosom of Abraham, and the righteous man, I don't even know where it says he went, but there's a gulf between them, and the rich man wants Abraham to allow Lazarus to dip his finger in the water and touch his tongue to relieve his torment, that whole thing. Well, what I'm calling a fundamentalist would be inclined to look at that and say, we have a description of hell here, and we have a description of heaven here on the other hand, because that's what Jesus said. Never mind that the genre that Jesus is using there is a fable. He doesn't intend it to be taken as a literal description of where Lazarus went after he died and where the rich man went after he died. The fable isn't even about that. Remember, that fable is setting up a punchline. They will not believe him, even if one should come back from the dead, they will not believe him. That's the punchline of the whole thing, is how hardened they are in their unbelief, such that even a coming back from the dead is not going to convince them to heed the teaching of Jesus or the warning. So that's what I mean by fundamentalism, is we just decide I'm going to take everything literally and realistically and as a realistic description, and you're some raging liberal if you deny that this is a literal description of heaven and hell. But more often than not, what Ehrman is going to do is to go with that kind of interpretation and then say, well, that's got problems. Yeah. It's got huge problems, but that's not evidence against the Bible being the Word of God. What that's evidence against is a wooden, literalistic, dogmatic interpretation of the Bible that doesn't take into account what the author actually means and what he's saying and how he's communicating it. And I would advocate we need to be thoughtful and intelligent in the way we approach what it is that the Bible is saying. And I think Ehrman is a good warning to us about that. Is a very good warning to us about that. Okay, let me end with this. Let me read you just this short paragraph and comment on his short paragraph about Peter's denials here. He says, the same can be said of Peter's denials of Jesus. In Mark's gospel, Jesus tells Peter that he will deny him three times before the cock crows twice. In Matthew's gospel, he tells him that it will be before the cock crows. Now, so notice my contention. To be before the cock crows is like saying before morning. Before the cock crows twice is like saying before you hear the second peep out of the rooster, if you can call it a peep. Well, which is it? Before the cock crows once or twice? See, he's assuming that it means the same thing in those parallel accounts. Is it once or twice? When I was in college, I purchased a book that was intent on reconciling differences of this kind. Some of you may be aware of this book. It was called The Life of Christ in Stereo. The author, Johnston Cheney, took the four gospel accounts and wove them together into one big mega gospel to show what the real gospel was like. For the inconsistencies in the account of the denials of Peter, the author had a very clever solution. Peter actually denied Jesus six times, three times before the cock crowed and three times before it crowed twice. This can also explain why Peter denies Jesus to more than three different people or groups of people in the various accounts. But here again, in order to resolve the tension between the Gospels, the interpreter has had to write his own Gospel, which is unlike any of the Gospels found in the New Testament. Now, I want to comment two things on that. It is true, The Life of Christ in Stereo was a rather odd work. Cheney Johnston was blind, and he had committed to memory the whole Greek New Testament, I believe. Certainly the Gospels, but I think even the whole New Testament. Phenomenal feat. But Cheney Johnston had the perspective that what God did when he had the Gospel accounts written is that God had in mind from the very beginning one inspired Greek text, some of which was in Matthew, some of which was in Mark, some of which was in Luke, and some of which was in John. And the only way you could really actually get the real gospel that God intended is to find literally word for word. This phrase from the Gospel of Mark goes between these sentences in the Gospel of Matthew, and this phrase from the Gospel of John goes here in the Gospel of Matthew, and he literally wove together the different phrases, Greek phrases, from the four Greek texts of the four Gospels into one Gospel. This is what I'm talking about the fundamentalist approach. The idea that what we have in the Bible is not the writing of Matthew and the writing of Mark and the writing of Luke and the writing of John. This is the writing of God. And God just used Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John to kind of record what it is he wanted them to record. But if we really want to know the true gospel, the one that God wanted us to have, we need to reassemble it and go to the four different gospels to reassemble it. Now, I hope that's not too much of a caricature of what Mr. Johnson was doing, but that's basically the approach that he took. Is Ehrman right to find that problematic? Absolutely. Yeah, that can't be our approach to reconciling the gospel accounts. That's one of those pious fictions that we need to reject, on the one hand. On the other hand, he's making a different point. He's saying, but here again, in order to resolve the tension between the gospels and the interpreter has to write his own gospel, which is unlike any of the gospels found in the New Testament. And isn't it a bit absurd to say that, in effect, only my gospel, the one I create from parts of the four in the New Testament, is the right one, and that the others are only partially right? Next week, we'll look at the accounts of the empty tombs, and that's exactly what I'm going to do. I'm going to suggest that to get the full picture of the events surrounding the visits to the empty tomb, we have to reconstruct a story the entirety of which does not occur in any of the four Gospels. But the entire story we can triangulate from the four Gospels and come to realize exactly what happened in the events that surrounded that. So I'm doing what he calls absurd. I will be doing what he calls absurd. Isn't it a bit absurd to say that, in effect, only my gospel, the one I create from the parts of the four in the New Testament, is the right one, and that the others are only partially right? Why is that so absurd? Take the four accounts of my vacation that I handed out to the class. The only possible way they were going to have a fuller, more complete, more accurate understanding of the chronology of my vacation is to take all four, the evidence from all four, into account. That makes all the sense in the world, because when you have multiple accounts, you get greater detail supplied to you. One account includes details that the other accounts don't have. So if they are all accurate, if they are all true, if they are all without errors, of course, the fuller account that I'm going to reconstruct from all of my sources is going to be a better, truer, more accurate, and fuller account than any of the four partial accounts that are the sources. I mean, not only is that not absurd, that makes all the sense in the world. Of course, that's the way it's got to work. The reason I only have partial accounts in the other four Gospels is they weren't trying to give me the whole story. There was no point in them giving me the whole story. They didn't care to give me the whole story because they had different purposes. But if my purpose is to be a historian, the very thing that Ehrman encourages us to do, if my purpose is to be a historian and to actually understand the historical event for what actually transpired, I need to use all the sources I can possibly get. And if those sources are true and accurate, they're going to lead me to a true and accurate reconstruction of the event as it actually happened. And that's going to become vital next Sunday when we talk about the empty tomb, because the biggest conflicts in those accounts are assuming that Luke is describing the same event as Matthew and Mark, and I'm going to argue he's not. It's an entirely different event. And that's why it doesn't read the same, because it didn't happen the same, because it was a different event.